It's just after I see a movie, I like to go get a piece of pie and talk about it. It's sort of a little tradition I have. Do you like to get pie after you see a good movie?
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to A Piece of Pie, the queer film podcast. We are back from our hiatus. We are talking queer horror films, and we couldn't talk queer horror films without talking to two queer horror experts, the directors of Scream Queen, My Nightmare on Elm Street. I am here this week with Max and Tyler Jensen and Roman Chiaminti. Hello, boys.
Hello.
Hey,
hello.
How are you?
I am an expert on being queer and watching horror movies.
Yes. Well, you directed the documentary on one of the definitive queer horror films of our time. So it was only right that I invite you on. And thank you for agreeing. I'm so excited. If longtime listeners remember, we did an interview with Mark Patton. I believe something had happened with your flight and you didn't get there until the event had started. So I didn't meet you guys until
later. We were fashionably late to our own party, which was not cool, but we were happy to be there. It was a wild time. I love the Cell Block Bar, and that was an exceptionally fun night.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. I used to work at a gay bar across the street, and I spent a great deal of time at Cell Block after my shifts. But this week, we're not talking about Cell Block or leather bars. We did that episode already. We're doing queer horror for Halloween. We're returning from our hiatus. And one of the queerest, probably the most successful queer filmmaker the 80s and 90s, Joel Schumacher, directed a couple. In the middle of his career, he did the classic Lost Boys and Flatliners, which are the two films we're discussing. Of course, Schumacher is notorious for Batman Forever and Batman and Robin, which I'm sure are going to come up at some point.
Don't give it away.
I've been petitioning you for that for a long time, Brian. I want to
know
Batman and Robin because I want to know that Batman and Robin is a much better movie than Forever.
I don't even know where to begin with that, other than which is which. Who's Batman and who's Robin?
Which Batman? There's a million Batmans. But anyway, let's dive right into The Lost Boys, a sort of seminal 80s film that I realized that I had seen the first hour way more than I had seen the last half hour.
This happens to me as well. I was watching it not too long ago. I watched it again last night to prepare for this, but the time before, there was a whole hour that I had forgotten about, and it's only a 90-minute movie.
I've watched that movie start to finish so many times since it came out, so I'm not in your camp. I love that movie start to finish, like, and normally I'm the one that's like, I checked out after like 50 minutes, but or like I've caught the end, but in this case I've seen every bit of it a million times because I heart Corey Haim and always have. But
he is so cute in this movie.
He really is.
He's cute in every fucking movie, but what about you, Max?
I came to this one much later. I think Brian's bringing me in for the ringer for Flatliners, as I've seen that one about 30 times. But I think it wasn't only until about 5 years ago that I finally got around to Lost Boys. And then I was just like, I think I was just out of the age for the VHS era. You know, it came out when I was 2 years old. But I was shocked by how gay it was and that I missed out on all the fun.
Oh, right? No.
It's very erotic.
My key Lost Boys memory is always seeing the VHS at the video store, and like its tagline, which I don't remember.
Party all night. It's fun to be a vampire.
Yeah. Thank you. I remember seeing that, but the video store was rated R. Video store wouldn't let me rent it, and eventually it was on TBS, and I taped it. And watched it that way.
Do you have older siblings? Are you an only child? Is this
No, I have an older brother. I'm the middle child. I have an older and a younger brother.
And they didn't like rent it and let you watch it?
No, they were, well, my older brother was only 2 years older than me and wasn't as interested in movies. And I would go to the video store and walk around for hours and like try and find something to watch. Right. Where he didn't give a shit. So
I got really lucky. I have two older siblings and a bunch of younger siblings, but they were like 13 years older than me. So they were teenagers by the time I was really young, and I was getting all of their pop culture in real time at a very young age. So I saw everything from 88 to 93 in like as it was happening. It was accessible to me, and I love these movies. Lost Boys was certainly one of them that was on heavy rotation all the time.
I mean, this is definitely rated R, but it like feels much more like a kid's movie anyway.
Right, right. It is a teen horror movie for sure.
According to the Internet Movie Database, it was originally written as a Goonies-esque adventure with children.
Right,
and,
right.
And Richard Donner was going to direct it, and he had directed Goonies, of course. And then he ended up doing Lethal Weapon and hired Joel Schumacher to do this.
Right.
Joel Schumacher, coming off of like Sadie Emil's Fire, was like, no, they have to be teenagers. It has to be sexy.
Right. Is this the same year as Monster Squad, or is it like, it seems like they did the right thing, because if it was Lost Boys and Monster Squad, both aiming for the Goonies market.
Yeah, they were both 1987. I just looked them up.
Nice, nice. They're in the moment. I love, you know, the scenes where they go to the video store, because that's where I wanted to be as a kid, and they don't exist anymore. So I get really nostalgic when I see them. And there's two giant posters for Goonies and European Vacation, which are oddly similar when you put them right next to each other.
Can I ask you guys a question?
Absolutely.
Before I get on my soapbox later about the decade, but how do you guys feel about the Lost Boys? Like now that, like, because I feel like I'm actually quite a bit older than you. I remember when it came out. And I feel like there's been this whole Lost Boys resurgence lately, which makes me super happy. But how do you, because if you, Max, were two when that movie came out, it wasn't like rippling with you at that time. It had to just be something you might have, you know, tucked in your brain until you're old enough to maybe watch it. And then at that point, it was probably a little bit outdated. So, well, no, you said it was 5 years ago that you watched it. But do you like the movie?
You know, I had a really good time with it. You know, it was, growing up, I had Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the original movie, on VHS, and that's what I watched with my friends over and over again. So I think it just got filtered out of like, I've got no time, I want to watch Buffy again rather than Lost Boys. But watching this just recently to prepare for this episode, I think it was just Pete Davidson who said it on SNL, but it's something about the 80s that it's both simultaneously the gayest and the most homophobic decade at the same time. And that's kind of how I feel about The Lost Boys too, and a lot of Joel Schumacher's filmmaking, is that it really just kind of leans into all of this really, you know, homoerotic imagery, but it's still just kind of like no homo, bro, you know, between all the vampires too. But I had fun, you know. I finally like absorbed enough of the cultural catchphrases that I had heard when I was a kid, how many times Michael was said in this movie over and over and over again, and just how
just cute, like Carol Ann and Poltergeist 3, they just never stop screaming her name. Yeah.
I didn't save her.
There's a really funny bit. I think it's Albert Brooks talks about you can tell a bad screenwriter by how often they use the characters' names.
That's true.
Not that this is a bad screen. I wouldn't say this is a bad screenplay. I would also say that it's Max, you mentioned, you know, there's that sense of like no homo amongst the vampires. I would heartily disagree with that. There is Kiefer Sutherland is actively pursuing Jason Patrick in this movie, and is jealous that Jamie Gertz star has gotten the attention from him. But as for Roman's question, I do like the movie. Like I said, I remember watching it. I had to tape it off of television when I finally watched it for the first time, but I had it on DVD for the longest time. I've seen it, like I said, I've seen it a lot, and I have seen the ending a number of times, but I've definitely seen the first hour more. And I love the first hour. I love when they get to the town. I love that world building.
That montage, it feels like documentary filmmaking.
Yeah, right, yeah. I love all of that. I even love like the Echo and the Bunnymen cover of the Doors. Like, I just love all of that. I really do. I like it a lot. I think it's a fun movie. I hadn't seen it in a while, but it was really fun to visit here.
I grew up there. So where they filmed The Lost Boys is 25 minutes away from where I lived. And my cousin lived right near that Santa Cruz boardwalk. So I grew up, I was there like every other weekend. And I remember when that movie came out, I was like, that's the bridge I play on like every fucking Sunday. Like it was amazing. And I remember that
when you play on this bridge, are you on top of it or hanging off the bottom of it?
Well, it was as high off the ground as it looks in the movie. Clearly they weren't hanging off a bridge in the movie, but it was funny because like, it was like probably 1 foot of water at the base. So if you fall, you're doomed, right? So like, no, we weren't like hanging off that bridge, but we did cross it all the time to go ride those rides. And so, you know, where, you know, that whole, when The Lost Boys came out, it was more than just like, and I was at the age where I was like, you know what? I want to dress different. I love Depeche Mode. I love all this cool shit. And I love vampires and all that. So this movie really hit me. But at the same time, it was also like, wait, that's where I play every weekend. You know, like we go hang out. We didn't even need parents with us. So it was even more cool. Because there was always the older kids drinking beer all over the beach and the rides, and we're, you know, like pining to be just like them. So it was like this movie was like the perfect embodiment of my coming of age. So I love it. There you go.
Interesting that when I was coming of age as well, I'm watching this movie. I'm watching Stand By Me and Fried Green Tomatoes. And I severely think that I'm going to have a really important life experience with an oncoming train. And it has never happened to me.
I think that's
okay.
For the best.
You lived with me. I thought that was close enough for you, but okay.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. You know, so Roman and I used to live together while we were making Scream Queen. And his apartment is right over these railroad tracks, which I didn't notice at the time. And the first night I stayed there, it was the loudest noise that I had ever heard in my entire life. At the same time, the next door neighbors were having the most violent screaming match I've ever heard that lasted for hours. I put on Interview with a Vampire on TV and I watched the whole thing and they were still screaming by the end
of it. Were you crying too? You cried.
It was an emotional day.
It was like that scene from Big where he checks into the motel and cries.
I just want to be big.
Sorry, diversion.
Were you...
Take it away, Brian.
No, I love that story. Thank you. That's definitely staying in there. I used to live here in Chicago under an L track, and it was miserable.
Right, so, right.
My sympathies.
But, you know, I heard it the first night, and then I never noticed it again.
Oh, really?
Well, I was actually referring to myself as the train that was going to run you down, but that was...
I survived.
that apartment is where I started to regularly watch movies with subtitles, because the train going by so often, I couldn't, there would be whole swaths of dialogue that I would miss. So and to this day, I often am watching new movies with subtitles, because anyway.
I would move.
It was a very short.
I do want to say that, like, I think it's, I'm super interested to know, I'm fascinated with the way 80s movies are perceived by people that weren't there at the time, like of age, you know what I mean? Because this is the time, it's been 30 years. This is the time where they're back. Just like in the 80s, they were always calling back to the 50s. And now we're calling back to the 80s, because for so long, all I've heard was slander for 80s stuff. I've heard people like make fun of stuff or like disregard them. And now the younger people are really kind of connecting with them. And I love it. it's for different reasons than I initially liked them, but we're still, you know, on the same team. So I'm kind of fascinated to know more about like why you guys like this movie, or, you know, what it means for you.
Yeah, like I said, I watched it. I was very aware of it, but I was forbidden from watching it because it was rated R. So if it came out in 87, I was 7 years old. So I was a few years behind where it was being depicted, but I think in a lot of ways I was its target audience.
For the Frog Brothers.
Yeah, exactly. I was contemporaries with the Frog Brothers, basically. But like I said, I didn't see it until years later. I think by the time I saw it was when I was like 13 or 14 years old, because it had been sort of kept from me. And it's interesting because growing up, I watched R-rated movies with my family all the time. I watched When Harry Met Sally with my parents, and I remember watching RoboCop with my dad. but this one, for some reason, when I would try to rent it, that was
do you think the inherent sexuality of vampires is part of the reason they're like, absolutely not?
I think so, because it was I couldn't really get horror films when my parents were renting movies, and all of the Nightmare on Elm Street movies that I saw, I would see with like friends or on television. But
yeah, it's basically funny how
I didn't hang out with anyone who loved it, so I never got to see it. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I'm sorry. I think it's interesting how, and I don't think it was a conscious decision by our parents, but like a lot of them are like, oh, this movie, Terminator seems like big dicks and muscles, so sure, watch it, kid. But if it seems like
if anything, that was on the poster, I would get it tattooed on my body.
Well, that's going to be the tagline of our next movie, but I think that's kind
don't give it away.
That's really the way things have worked for a long time. It's
right,
like,
right.
Like, hey, you're gonna watch a whole bunch of people get blown up and torn to bits. That's cool, because that's what boys are supposed to like. But if it's something, if the poster even seems a little, if there's any sort of sexuality that could be picked up on in any way, then it's inappropriate. And we still suffer from that a little bit today, you know. It doesn't hold movies back from getting out there, and kids have exposure to things regardless if their parents want them to or not, but it still exists. But you got there, so that's all that matters.
Yeah, I eventually discovered it, and it was one that I carried with me all through high school. I remember liking it and like kind of going to bat for it in high school.
There's a lot to like in this movie. The creature effects, the makeup are wonderful. It has this fresh teenage dialogue that actually is a little bit of annoying to me now, but at the time I'm like, yeah, these are like cool kids fighting vampires. This is what I want in life. I am happy that this movie was popular, that they made more horror films for kids, because that's what I was eating as soon as I got of age to rent my own videos. It's like, I want more of this.
I know. So I have to admit right off the bat, like, Tyler is definitely more of like he's more savvy with directors and their careers. And I'm actually more of someone that's like, you know what? I fucking love that soundtrack, and that I loved it. And that, so I follow the bands, I follow the music, I follow the style. And sometimes it'll be 15 years later, I'm like, who made that movie? I have no idea. You know, so.
I'm like, girl, he made all of our favorite movies.
Yeah. So, but I think there's a lot of the angles that I take tend to be different. So maybe that's why we have good conversation. But this movie, you know, the 80s was kind of a peak for movies that were then had soundtracks that were blown out of the water, right? Like that, they kind of perfected the soundtrack as we know it now, beyond just the score. It's like, let's take a whole bunch of cool bands and make them famous too, because then they'll help give us marketing and like make us a lot of money. This soundtrack was everywhere, and it established the popularity of this movie more so than the movie itself, because it came out at a time where the actual goth scene was becoming a name that people could speak. Even though none of the music on it, except for the main title, was actually considered like kind of, you know, gothy style. But it just like, it just had NXS on it. It would echo on the Bunny Man. It was really fucking cool, you know? And I think everybody knows the Cry Little Sister song. Like it
right.
will be the one that stands out to you. And it's just, I feel like as far as soundtracks go, they really took a chance with doing something really dark as opposed to like having, you know, if you look at like Fright Night, they don't really have any dark music on the soundtrack. They just have some popular artists that, you know, the Jay Giles band that would like put on another song, but it wasn't something that was creepy Halloween sounding like this one. This one right. really knocked it out of the park.
This is 87. Is this the same year as like Night of the Demons?
Yes.
I think so. I think well, it's just most horror movies were doing heavy metal. And this is that transition between where it was like, no, you know what? Let's do like rock, like pop rock, you know? So
okay.
the main song, Cry Little Sister, everyone thinks it's the Sisters of Mercy, but it's not. It's Gerard McMahon, who was like a, you know, a composition writer. He's like, let's just do something really dark and creepy. And that took off. And then everyone wanted him to do that kind of style afterwards. I'm really into the music side of stuff. So.
Well, I think it's that 1980s like MTV effect where music videos are suddenly now really popular. And now you can make a music video and incorporate scenes from your movie. And now MTV is going to play this hit song that's good for them. And then the record's going to sell. The record company is going to sell records, which is good for them. And the more people are going to go see the movie. And it's just, I mean, I think Joel Schumacher later in his career would, I mean, Batman Forever had an iconic soundtrack at the time with Kiss from a Rose.
And Batman and Robin too. Both of them were better soundtracks than they were movies.
That Smashing Pumpkins song from the second one. Good. Yeah, they were
good.
He was instrumental in those in movie soundtracks for that period, I feel like. But I do think it goes back to it being the 1980s, and it was just this cycle of selling product that really, I think when that started.
By the late 80s, it became, and I've talked about this a bunch on shows, but like the late 80s is when corporate hands really took a grip on film. And it doesn't mean the films were bad, but it means that they were like, okay, you know what? We're going to give you less money for these effects, but we're going to give you a lot more money for this music. You know, we want like a good soundtrack we can sell, because the music is actually the most expensive part to license. You know, as we know with our movie, like it's, you can figure out ways around getting clips to use, but goddamn it, the music in a commercial is going to cost you your life. Like it is expensive because they know that that's what resonates with people is sound. And, you know, joining forces with a lot of these bands was an expensive endeavor. So, you know, by the time we got to the late 80s and 90s, all bands wanted to be on a soundtrack because people bought them, even if they hadn't seen the movie, myself included. I was like, I love that movie. I'm going to go buy that soundtrack regardless because I'm excited for it, you know? But when did you do that before the 80s, before the mid 80s? Like, no one was running out to buy soundtracks of movies they hadn't seen.
I had The Exorcist Turbular Bells disco anthem.
The disco version, yeah.
Too awesome. Young to watch the movie, but I have the disco version.
One of the first CDs I ever bought was the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles soundtrack with Turtle Amazing. Power on it.
Teenage Mutant Turtle Ninja Power.
Yeah, that one. Doesn't not the it, Vanilla it Ice has, one.
It has
that was part two.
Vanilla Ice was two, but the one you just sang was from part one, which is what I had.
It was good. I had that too. I honestly, my first job was mowing lawns so that I could save up money to buy the Batman Forever soundtrack, which I listened to on my cassette player, Walkman, while I mowed more lawns.
I will say that The Lost Boys is one of those movies that I think, normally I kind of cringe a little bit when people try to, like, you know, look back on 80s movies and give them more importance than I think they really were intending at the time. But I do think The Lost Boys, with its director, and especially, like, that era of AIDS and everything that was going on, I think it's a pretty remarkable movie, considering how tight a grip the business side of things had on film at the time, that they were able to make this movie, because it was pretty outrageous if you think about it, especially considering that they were the focus was more for kids or young adults, you know, because we take for granted the fact that you've got like Goosebumps and Fear Street and all these movies now that are like that are blatantly for children, but we didn't have horror for children then. Mm-hmm. There was some bad horror, but not for kids, really.
Since I came to this one later, that was a bit of the perspective I was trying to think of watching it this time around again, too, was what did this influence? How was it influential? And it really was. And by really having a great idea that it executed very well, which was, hey, young, sexy vampires. We haven't really done that in a while. I mean, the 80s are littered with vampire movies, but you're mostly getting really weird stuff or self-referential like Fright Night or Vampire's Kiss with Nicolas Cage or Near Dark or Martin. You know, things that are very
like
serious.
Sexual taboos, for sure.
Yeah, things that are not fun, you know, in a traditional type of sense, or much too arch. Whereas this is just earnest B-movie schlock, basically like marrying vampires with the Brat Pack, including, I think, called the Bat Pack at this point, too. I actually really like that.
That's awesome.
So, I mean, there's obviously a straight line that can be made to not just Twilight, but Vampire Diaries, everything else that really put a lot of the sex and the youth and the hipness back into vampires of the 90s. You know, Interview with a Vampire, I suppose that's kind of young and hip in its way, but that movie moves at its own slow pace.
Right. And
much more obviously another art, you know, an art film.
It wasn't cool.
Movie. Right.
It wasn't cool.
Well, which is why I think that this one lasts long enough in people's VHS players and sleepovers for, you know, two decades, three decades at this point, because it's fun to revisit, because it's taking, you know, again, the indulgence of the late 80s, those special effects, some really cool vampire, you know, deaths and effects, you know, of like, you can tell that like a lot of this is overheated children, you know, overgrown children writing their own screenplay of like, and then they push the vampire into the bathtub with holy water and garlic. And it's just kind of like, all right. And you know, like, Tyler, that's what made me remember like Monster Squad too, something that's a lot more of a satire, a little bit more arch, but also has that type of like very enthusiastic, you know, people behind the camera, in front and behind the camera. People want to make this because they really enjoy vampire movies and monsters and Echo and the Bunnymen on the soundtrack. So I do think that that's what still carries over for this film year after year.
There is enough fog and atmosphere and wind machines and
oiled up guys playing the saxophone. And
oh my God. I, you know, whenever I watched this as a kid, did not have my sexual awakening. I'm noticing it now in this viewing, and Jason Patrick in that saxophone scene, looking at Star, I was like, who is this man? Where is this man? I need to be this man.
Can I just say that like they literally had bands performing like that all the time. So like,
okay, because that was there. That is a good question. So this movie and Back to the Beach all have these outdoor like gutter punk street things. Like, is this a normal thing? Do you have bonfires on the beach and bands play?
Because it's this weird hybrid. The reason why this movie is awesome is because it actually was the first time Hollywood got punk a little bit right. It's not totally right. It's like this movie gets classified as like goth vampires. Those vampires are Guns N' Roses fans with better hair. That's all they say. They're not real goth, but we still go hand in hand, not just the vampires, but they got kind of like the Santa Cruz. It's like this weird Bill and Ted Back to the Beach type of aesthetic that California produced, which is like a hybrid of surfer, skater, metal, and throw eyeliner in there, you know? And it was something that was more of an MTV creation than an actual style. But there were young kids like me that were trying, like, you know, I wasn't old enough to be super cool, but I could start dabbling with Wet n Wild and figure my way out, you know? So it was a great movie to pull me closer to who I wanted to be. And I loved like the spiky hair and the overcoats and the cool music and the bad attitudes. And I feel like overall it got it right, you know, right. And it made me super happy.
I love all the fashion in this movie, except that little 7-year-old vampire with the
jacket.
The Sergeant Pepper thing.
Right. I'm like, what?
Yeah, that's supposed to make them seem like they're like nomads or like, we have no home. I'm like, at least get him a jacket that you would actually find somewhere.
Right? Like, I would Nobody see that kid that. Running around Brooklyn today, but I don't believe it. 40 years ago, 30 years ago.
I mean, they made him seem like his parents were related, which sucks. But other than him, I agree with you.
Well, maybe that kid was several hundred years old.
Right.
Good call.
Maybe he just had that jacket the whole time.
He was one of the producers of Sergeant Pepper.
Yeah.
Oh, back to like the storytelling of all this movie kind of relies on the thing where if you kill the head vampire, they all go back to normal. That's my least favorite in a horror movie. It feels like a cop out because a lot of these things, like if you're gonna have a horror movie with stakes, the main character has to lose somebody that we care about. And in stories like this, when you can just kind of cure everybody and they can be good again if you kill the head vampire, come on. Kill your darlings, let their deaths hurt so that we as the audience connect deeper with the movie. If everything goes back to normal at the end, I'm like, well,
well, okay. That's why this strikes me as a kid's movie versus like Near Dark, where it's just kind of like, and then they all turned human again. And it's like a cartoon, you know, sitcom, you know, reset at the end of the episode type of approach by the end of it.
The mom in Lost Boys, what's her name?
Diane Wiest.
Yes.
Who always looks like she's about to cry. Always, right?
Always. I celebrate her every spring. It's called Diane Wiester, and she has risen. All right.
You're stupid. What?
Yeah, this is a gay podcast.
No, I'm so glad you brought that up because I did want to discuss the cast because it's loaded. Diane Wiest, Jason Patrick, Corey Feldman, Corey Haim, Kiefer Sutherland. But the one I wanted to mention was Mr. Gilmore himself, Edward.
Oh, Burnham. Yes. But isn't the head vampire? He's not Daddy Warbucks, is he? From Annie?
No, he's the head vampire. I said
no, but he wasn't Richie Rich.
Oh no, he was Roosevelt in Annie.
Sure.
Oh yeah, that's right.
That makes sense. I just wanted to give props to the late great Edward Herman.
He is great. Is he related to? Never mind.
You're thinking of Herman Munster, aren't you?
I certainly was. How did you know that?
Because I made the same mistake.
Gwen. Yeah.
Because exactly, I made the same mistake. That's why I made sure to write it down because I kept thinking of them in my mind. I was like, I have to write down this name.
It's so funny. He said that and I saw Ed Gwynn's face in my memory, or Fred Gwynn's face in my mind.
Right. And I'm like, Pet Cemetery, I love you.
I'm looking it up now because I think I'm on your all team, but like, I'm trying to remember what else, because I've seen him in a million things, but like, oh, he was in Annie. Shut up. That's awesome. Been in a lot of stuff. It's so funny because like every time I think of this guy, I only picture him in The Lost Boys.
My favorite thing of this movie is Corey Haim's bedroom.
Yes.
Not only do we get a poster from one of my favorite movies of all time, Reform School Girls, we also get this super sexual poster of Rob Lowe for reasons I do not know. Put that there. Why is it there? And can I have it when you're done?
Ew. Because he had just done St. Elmo's Fire. And, you know, like any smart director, he's going to have his entourage of people that he pulls in, which he did for this movie. But
there's a poster of Molly Ringwald on the other side of the bedroom as well. That is for the character. And I'm like, are you saying something here that I should know about? Not only are you loving Wendy O. Williams and Pat Ast of Reform School, but you're going to put Rob Lowe on the back of the door so only you can see it when your door is closed and no one else can.
Well, right. not to give spoilers, but in Flatliners, he has the cure in this one. The one guy who doesn't get put under has a cure poster. And I feel like it's kind of like a John Hughes situation where it's these weirdos that don't necessarily have a direct, I'm talking about the directors, that don't have a lot of, you know, flamboyant style themselves, but they're drawn to that eccentricity. So they knew the cool bands at the time, or they knew the cool underground, like, you know, the cults. It wasn't cult at the time, but like Reformed Schoolgirls. If you liked that, you knew who Wendy O. Williams was of the Plasmatics. You knew that she was essentially just like, you know, the rebel rocker that like most people haven't heard of.
The oldest juvenile delinquent in history.
Which, if you want fun fact, one of our assistant editors on Scream Queen is her nephew.
Right, which is so wild to me.
Jesse Amazing. Is her nephew. That's so weird. Sorry, go on.
Oh, it's okay.
This movie is a style icon for the generation right now. I don't know how
the dangly earring generation.
Exactly, the gays in the Midwest, if they're doing this, but everywhere on the West Coast and East Coast that I can see, everyone's got sketchbook tattoos and dangly earrings and fashion mullets. It's like we are in the era the Lost Boys promised us. I felt this way a few years ago when there was a resurgence of like bright silk colored Hawaiian shirts. And I'm like, oh my God, we're living in Romeo and Juliet. From the 90s, now we're in the Lost Boys. It is prophetic.
And 80s aesthetic back for sure.
Right. As long as no fucking kids are wearing that fucking marching band outfit, we're fine. Yeah.
But what do you guys feel about? So, you know, Schumacher's been pretty, he's on the record for being very sexual in his promiscuity, and he made comments about how he felt like it was AIDS might be his destiny. Don't quote me on this, but that you know, he felt like it was sort of like something that he was going to have to deal with. Do you think that carried over into his work, or do you think that that's just something that we're sort of imposing on it now with hindsight?
I think the back to back of these two movies that we're talking about today, about confronting death and like making and investigating it, is it doesn't come at this time in history for as an accident. Like, it definitely feels like this is heavy on his mind and he's thinking about it all the time. Here's a fun way to do it, and then we're going to have a much darker version of it in the next film.
But do you think that he was choosing the movies? Because the other problem is that sometimes they would, like, you know, you take what you can get. When Hollywood became like this well-oiled machine, it wasn't like everybody was able to just do whatever the fuck they wanted. A lot of times we think directors had all these like, you know, deep intentions, and they were just like, this is they finally offered this to me, I'm going to fucking do it, you know?
Right. But like at this point in his career, he's made hit movies. He's not writing these himself. So they're not coming from him directly, but he is reading scripts and like, yeah, this is a world I want to go with.
This is the movie that made him famous. St. Elmo's Fire and Lost Boys. This is what got him on the map. He wasn't a darling yet. It wasn't until this one became a hit that he became, that's how he was able to get Batman, is from Flatliners and Lost Boys. Before this, I don't think he really had massive success, really. Did he?
I feel like the success of St. Elmo's Fire probably led.
Yeah.
Directly
right,
to
right.
another sort. I mean, it's just some of the same actors, like you talked about, that he works with, and I definitely think there's a line from St. Elmo's Fire to the Lost Boys, but also from the Lost Boys, and kind of getting to explore that side. I definitely think it's there. I think that, I mean, the vampires are all very much like othered and everyone's afraid of them, right? And like they're. Sort of infiltrating this like fractured 80s family dynamic, and like it's a threat, and the other is a threat. And so like, it has to be beat back. And I definitely think that he found that in the script and explored that openly. And the success of it, I think, allowed him to go deeper with Flatliners. Even if I think the script and that movie are inferior to this, I think that's,
he was trying to be more mature, for sure.
Yeah. I think there's a clear line from those movies, those three movies.
So you think there's an intentional influence by the era, like just from a gay angle, let's say.
Yeah.
You think so?
Absolutely. Because he's an out filmmaker, and everyone knows that he's gay.
At this time?
Yeah. He used to work in fashion before this.
He was a designer, true. Yeah. But I don't recall him being an out director until later, until the 90s, when it became like, I could be wrong here. Maybe you guys should school me, but I feel like it wasn't until after Clive Barker came in from the UK and was like, I'm gay, here's Demons and Dicks and deal with it, that everyone was like, okay, you know, we can, you know, we're not that creepy. So I don't know him being out yet,
but I think that I prefer Nightbreed over this movie a little bit more too, Roman.
I mean, Clive Barker is my hero, but
that one's just so much more direct in its queer imagery and what it's saying. Whereas I think to your question, you know, this one dances around it a little bit more. Right. You know, obviously there's Joel Schumacher's a horny director. I mean, we have both of those Batman movies and the crotch and nipples in our face to show us that any chance he'll sell sex to children too. And you know what? I do miss that. I miss, you know, how sexless Marvel movies and things have become. So I do miss that a little bit. But
the Aquaman movie is there for the queers and the theys and the thems. The children who are seeing Aquaman with their families are having a sexual awakening that they won't know how to deal with for another 10 years, but they will mark that movie as the underwater Lisa Frank Little Mermaid for boys that I wanted when I was a kid. It exists now, and I'm so happy.
I'm not going to rain on your parade, but I'm not in your camp with that
one. Yeah, I just wish that James Wan could direct a movie just a little bit, just one iota.
We'll save that for another podcast.
I know. But I just want to finish this thought, and this was to Brian's point, too, in some of the imagery and in confronting AIDS and HIV a little bit more on as the epidemic was ramping up, is that, you know, queerness and vampirism is just kind of endemic together, you know, and the meaning of sharing blood and tainted blood and the drinking of it and its danger in this movie is really pushed more to the forefront than I think it had been in a while, or maybe since The Hunger, another pretty goddamn gay vampire movie. And I really do think that's much more explicit of Joel Schumacher and queer people behind the camera inserting that into the film a little bit more.
Yeah, I don't know when he was making this. I can't for sure say that he was out publicly, but I feel like it would have been known in Hollywood in much the same way that like when actors previously, like Rock Hudson or whatever, like had that public. I don't know. Like I said, it seems so gay to me that I can't imagine anyone not knowing, basically.
Which we didn't know anything about Joel Schumacher's personal life really until watching this Halston show with Ewan McGregor. And he shows up as the 19-year-old strung out on heroin. And I'm like, that's the same Joel Schumacher? Oh my God.
You have to remember though, that era was different though. I'm not denying that there isn't a heavy-handed influence. I love exploring that. I think it's here. But at the same time, remember the decade itself was defined by an eccentricity that is influenced. Obviously, that is the ingredient behind Boy George and Madonna and Cyndi Lauper and all of these sort of over-the-top characters that we made, from Elvira to Pee Wee Herman. But there is also that wasn't necessarily the meaning behind it. It's that we had this sort of like split personality in this decade between like, let's be this caricature of something wild versus let's be this business suit guy that's a psycho hungry for money. Like, those are the two polar opposites that were defining that decade. And I feel like that a lot of I think we impose a lot of this intention now on stuff then that wasn't necessarily there. But I think watching this movie now, you can absolutely see how these stories have been colored from Schumacher's angle, especially with Flatliners, actually, I think more than Lost Boys. I adore Lost Boys. I think it is a wonderful movie. The fact in the 90s, when I was like full on goth and we were going to dance clubs every weekend and like, you know, eyeliner was just spilling out of my backpack at all hours. The Lost Boys wasn't cool anymore because that style was corny. But now it's back again and people appreciate it again and it's ringing true and that makes me happy. So
right.
Here we are.
Either you're the Lost Boys or you're the Craft. It's take your pick.
Or the Craft.
Yeah, Roman, I think what everything that you were just saying just honestly just goes right back down to that quote from earlier, which is the 80s were alternately the gayest and most homophobic decade at the same
Absolutely.
Time.
Absolutely. It's a love hate. It's bittersweet. I mean, that's why we made Scream Queen the way that we did it, was because I have been in love with the 80s since the 80s. And through the 90s, I'm like, this bullshit sucks. Like, I love, you know, but at the same time, like exploring this with Tyler and obviously Mark, I was able to unearth a lot of buried trauma that I'd had from that decade. And I think most people can say that about their formative years looking back, but this decade had a little extra that was like, okay, it wasn't just society. It was also in everything I saw too. So I appreciate the fact that Joel Schumacher was able to be ballsy. And it's not so much for me. I watch these movies. And I'm like, it's not even so much what they're saying or what they're doing, but it's in the lighting. It's in the way the camera is like adoring, you know, the establishing shots and the creating the mood that's more like in a way that other directors just don't always get, you know? If you don't have that gay aesthetic, you're not always going to throw a little glimmer on a steeple, you know?
Yeah. There's there's glitter in the blood. According to the Internet Movie Database, it doesn't get any gayer than that.
It doesn't get gayer than that. Perfect homage to the trauma that was going on with AIDS too. So, yeah. You know.
Or all of the things that have been influenced by The Lost Boys. It's funny that the one thing we haven't mentioned was the one that Max mentioned at the top, which he used to watch instead. One of the most influenced by this was Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And we just haven't, I don't know. I just wanted to throw that out there. Cause I think it's funny too, that Max would watch that movie instead of this movie.
Right. I mean, I did the same. I grew up and I adored Christy Swanson.
Oh yeah. I mean,
now I'm like, oh, why do you have to ruin everything I love?
No, that name is muted on Twitter for me. So I just don't feel disappointed most days.
Yes.
Lost Boys shares the director of photography with Taxi Driver.
Jan de Bont. Or
no, Jan de Bont is
Flatliners. Gotcha. Okay.
Michael Chapman is his name. He shot Taxi Driver.
That's nice.
Really?
I do love Schumacher's style. He's very much directing this movie like it's a music video. It's all style. Yeah. The camera is floating. It makes a lot of economic use of not showing the vampires flying by just having the camera move the way that it does and people getting sucked into the air. You're like, I don't know what's going on. And it's smart that we don't get our reversal shot of the gang of four picking people up. It's more effective the less we see. And this carries on to Flatliners as well. It's just the movie, the camera is constantly moving through wet corridors and the slats of plastic and
it's fashion lighting. He uses high fashion, like my friend Amber does fashion photography, and it's doing like all of these sets, his movie sets are set up like fashion photography sets with the overblown lights in the background to highlight stuff. Like nobody's apartment is going to be lit like that, you know, like an MTV video.
Oh, but it's gorgeous. And
that's what I love. Absolutely love it.
The, like the fake tree with the set behind them and the wind machine. I mean, this is where like, this is how you, this is like,
this is where the attention comes in for me, where I'm like, see, this is the gay aesthetic that you don't even know that you've been influenced by, and you need to appreciate it because we created the imagery you love.
Right.
You
it's know? Very like James Bidgood.
Elaborate. You know,
he did the movie that was the movie Pink Narcissist was inspired by his photography. It's very homoerotic, very like, you know, Twinkie boys with their asses out, but also in like fairy tale Narnia fantasy worlds with clouds.
Well, there's also Pierre and Gilles, the fashion photographers from Europe. Pierre and Gilles have shot every famous person you know and make them look like the gayest glittery airbrush. They actually influenced.
Did they shoot Beyonce?
I don't know, but it's, they've done Madonna, so. Date me.
Say less.
But like they've influenced that David LaChapelle look, which is like everyone's perfect, everyone's airbrushed, and they're doing something outrageous. And it's also like, you know, A-list celebrities doing crazy shit. But they also have like hard dicks and glitter in their photos. So if you don't know who Pierre and Gilles are, you should look them up. You will love them.
Yeah, I will definitely be looking him up. And I think this is a great place to stop and transition over to Flatliners. We're going to take a quick break and play some music for you, and we'll see you on the other side.
Going to Minnesota in the morning.
Oh, where to?
Minneapolis, but my parents are in Rogers and Monticello, and most of my siblings are in different parts of the state from there. Right, I haven't been in a couple years, so. But I'd like to go in October for my holiday visit. I am Uncle Spooky. I bring my nieces and nephews presents and candy and costumes. And then I get Thanksgiving and Christmas to not go home. And it's wonderful.
Yeah.
I wish I had known that. I would have had you introduce yourself as Uncle Spooky, was it?
Uncle Spooky. So I'm Uncle Spooky to my family. There is a horror host here in Brooklyn who I am friends with, who goes by Uncle Spooky, and he hosts movie nights on Fire Island. Starting in a couple of weeks, he's doing a Dragula viewing party.
That's awesome.
That goes into horror movies after that. He is the real Uncle Spooky. It would be a great movie.
Well, if only you knew a filmmaker.
I'm writing it right now.
Perfect.
Cross between Elvira, Mistress of the Dark, Jack the Bear, and something else.
Blackie.
Adventures in Babysitting. That's the movie.
Jack the Bear. That's a pull from the memory bank. I forgot about that movie. That's with Danny DeVito, right?
With Danny DeVito. Julia Louis-Dreyfus and Reese Witherspoon when she's still like 8 years old.
Oh, wow.
And this movie was only on HBO in the early to mid 90s. Never seen again. Never talked about again. But every time it was on TV, as a family, we watched it and it was devastating every time.
I've never seen it. I remember watching. The trailer would always show on. Remember the preview channel, and you would like go to the preview channel, and then you would just be watching the preview channel. But I saw the trailer a lot on that.
Right.
But I never saw it, and I kind of completely forgot about it. And then you said the name, and I was like,
oh, it's interesting that we had kind of this resurgence in the 90s of horror host, like centric movies. We had obviously Ed Wood got Oscar buzz. We have Jack the Bear, and then we had the movie Matinee with John Goodman as like a William Castle type.
Yeah.
That was when I was like, oh, I'm going to be a filmmaker when I grew up. And all these movies came out relatively short distance to each other. And I was like, oh, this is for me.
Awesome. I remember Matinee. That was Joe Dante, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I just got to see that on the big screen at the Music Box. That was
it good? I always think that I like it. And then I start watching it and being like, I got to go. I got to go do something else.
I think it's his
best movie. I've never even heard of this movie. Matinee.
Yeah, it's fun. It's like a 50s coming of age comedy, but
when did it come out?
Mid 90s, early 90s?
I think it's 1990. Like, I remember watching that one. It was like my version of The Sandlot. All the straight boys watched The Sandlot, and I was like, fuck you, I'm gonna watch Matinee.
And they're like, why?
I did go Dante's makeup, but I wasn't aware of any of, other than Gremlins, I wasn't like on the radar.
Yeah, this was in the era where John Goodman was trying to be like a leading man. He did super famous from Roseanne. He did Arachnophobia.
Same year.
Yeah.
King Ralph.
That was later. That was later. Well, mid. That was like 93 or 94. But it was 98 or 99 where I worked with Joe Dante. And I was in the museum. The Hollywood Museum in front of the Gremlins that he'd done. But like, had I known, I would have been like, but The Burbs is amazing. You know, like I don't know, whatever.
You gotta do your research with these bitches.
Well, when you get hired to do makeup on celebrities, sometimes they don't all, like at that time, they wouldn't always tell you, you knew what the project was for, but they wouldn't tell you who always. You just had to show up and they'd say a name, but you didn't know what it was about. So,
but see, like, here's an interesting factoid. They're like, if had you known who you were talking to, you could pitch these people. I do believe that Mel Gibson's makeup artist ended up directing a movie that he produced called Paparazzi, which everyone's like, why are you letting a makeup person direct movies? But it's happened.
Hello.
It's happened.
It's happened.
I haven't done the official, like, we're back and now we're going to talk about Flatliners, but I don't want to lose any of that either. So I'm just going to say it now.
You just go right with it. It's okay.
Absolutely.
We're giving you content.
Absolutely. Right? That was fascinating. but no, I liked what we were saying about Joel Schumacher shooting everything like a photo shoot, like a fashion photo shoot. That makes so much sense in regards to Flatliners, because one of my notes for Flatliners was it makes me want to like reset the coloring on my TV.
I'm like, to look this visual.
Like, it's not supposed to look like this. Something's wrong with my TV.
I love it.
Okay.
It's just the sepia tone of it.
Through a lot of saturated, you mean? Yes.
Yeah. It's just I love some of it. I love the sets, and I love the room where they go to like kill themselves, and I love how that looks. But like, I found that lighting and everything for the like Roman said, you wouldn't light your apartment like that, and I found it distracting at times.
No, I can appreciate that for sure. I grew up with sets. So, like, have you seen Risky Business at all lately?
Not lately, no.
Watch that movie, because that one came out in the earlier part of the decade, and it kind of defined the aesthetic. Like, there's this whole, like, rich people's minimalist aesthetic that carried through, and the way you have to light that is very similar to the way Schumacher lights stuff, which is, like, not practical at all. But by the later decade, they did that Plus, they blew everything out with like cross processing and, you know, let's make everything blue. You know, Flatliners is all blue, mm-hmm. right? And it's
you're me, living in that flat line. You see, we're gonna zoom into this flat line, and you're gonna be inside of it.
You're stupid. There, it's like if you've watched like a Billy Idol video, you know, where like it's the room is crazy and there's lightning and he's shirtless on a bed. Yeah, that's like the Flatliners like lighting. But if that wasn't like, you know, I had 10 years to evolve with that. So it wasn't a thing for me. But if you've watched, if you're watching this now, you're like, what am I looking at? This is a lot, you know, it's definitely surreal. And I think that that was the selling point of this movie at the time, was that it was like a more sophisticated, psychological, arty looking, scary film.
Right. But I feel like in the trajectory of the genre, we are post slasher movies. We're about to start on a serial killer craze. It yeah. takes us mostly into the 90s. This is like the hammock period where we're like, we don't know what to do. We don't want any more Freddy Krueger, Friday the 13th movies. And we have to do something else. But all the great classic movies of the early 90s haven't come out yet. So here's this like big budget, exquisitely photographed art piece, music video, feature film that is too long, that has every... hot young actor in one movie, and it just, I want to love it, I want to like it, and it doesn't really come together. Full disclosure, this is the very first horror movie I saw in the theater as a kid. My mom and my sister took me, and I had reoccurring nightmares of the boy in the red hoodie for years.
So it made an impression.
You were always scared of
it. It did. But you know, I was so young that I could overlook, like I wasn't holding on to the story. I was just feeling the mood and what I was seeing. So like it feels like a really important, heavy movie. Watching it now, I'm like, when, what? Huh? it has this feeling like it should be a Nightmare on Elm Street movie. Like we are so dedicated to this dream world and we are building these elaborate sets and it's all moody and wonderful, but you're missing that antagonistic element. Everything is just happening in these characters' heads and they're not really communicating about it, the whole climax of the movie feels unimportant, or there's no stakes. It's like you've all been dead forever. Like why should I care now? Spoils? I don't know. It just doesn't.
Well, I don't think that you were. So I remember when the movie came out, I was very excited to see it because we had finally closed the door on a lot of the schlocky horror. I had seen Nightmare on Elm Street 4 and 5 in the theater with my dad and left. You know, after Dream Child, I was like, what? This is like not exciting. Like it was just like forgettable, you know, Jason Takes Manhattan, forgettable, you know. And then we were like, let's just do a hard reset and start doing some like more sophisticated movies, right? Twin Peaks had come out. But I remember when Flatliners came out, I was like so excited because it seemed, the way they marketed it, it seemed like it was going to be like some fucking creepy shit. And then I watched it and I'm like, this is not creepy and it's boring. It starts off creepy, right?
Right.
And then it just gets kind of boring for a kid. But now that I watched it as an adult, I agree with what you're saying. But I was like, I actually like this movie now. I can watch this. It's a slow. It's weird. It's a slow burn that then doesn't deliver. But first half of this movie is excellent. You know, it seems like really like it makes you feel sick. Like I'm going somewhere I don't want to go.
All of these
actors are exceptional. All of the settings make you feel like whatever's going to happen here, no one's going to find me. I'm fucked. That's exactly what you want, right?
Right.
And then at the end, it's like, no, you got to say you're sorry. So it's, you know, kind of they drop the ball with that. But I can't, it's not his sophomore movie, but it did feel like a sophomore slump in the sense that it was like, you know, people expect excitement if you've given them that. And with this one, you don't get that. But it's beautiful. And the acting is superb. He has a whole cast of fabulous people. The music, which I always love to talk about, actually, I didn't look this up, but I feel like the composer was the same as Lost Boys. If you listen to the score, it's pretty good. I feel like he had all the elements there, but I remember one of the notes I took watching this was, I feel like this was a really great story that somebody said, we got to just like speed this up. And they cut from chapter 6 to 10. And we went from like, right when like shit's getting crazy to, okay, now let's wrap it up. Like that's just my take on it. I kind of feel like it
needs like a Dream Warriors moment where everyone's in the same nightmare.
Yeah.
To like help each other. I think
the ending is very anticlimactic.
Right.
Yeah.
It's very like, they're like, oh, they have to bring back Kiefer Sutherland, even though they've hated him the entire movie. And
in my notes, I'm like, why won't you let him die? Let him die.
Well, because then they're on the hook for it, of course.
The premise of Flatliners is really interesting. You know, it's like all of these renegade surgeons or medical geniuses that are in this really, really eccentric environment that want to just like experiment with the taboo. Well, and they find a way to sort of like find their way there, almost like another land, another world. And then they start doing it. And then shit goes crazy. But as soon as shit goes crazy, they jump to the resolution instead of letting it really tear everybody apart.
Right.
And you know that Schumacher's like aesthetic could have really like been cool for that, you know? Yeah. And I don't know if the dream sequence, not dream sequences, but you know, when they're in the other world where they're like in the fields and the trees and they're envisioning what their other side is, you know, it's very staged.
Yeah.
But I still love it. It still looks cool.
I love the fields. I love that one shot, like it looks like it wouldn't have been because it was, but that basically helicopter shot over the field. First one, when Kiefer Sutherland like dies for the first time. But to go back to what you were saying, like how it exists in this like sort of hammock state, I can completely understand why, where people are getting tired of the Freddy movies and, you know, Silence of the Lambs is out and it hasn't gotten quite so self-referential yet. I can see why you would, with that idea, take that to Joel Schumacher, who had just done The Lost Boys and delivered at least a modest hit, and also like bring over some of the cast, like bring over Kiefer Sutherland. And it's definitely, you're right, it's not a sophomore movie, but it feels like the same kind of crew getting together again to make another movie and to end kind of like going all in on it. And it doesn't work because it doesn't feel as thought out.
Right.
I remember that Julia Roberts had obviously just done Pretty Woman and was like, you know, riding high on that.
Is this the same year as Pretty Woman?
They came out the same year, yeah. Okay. I think that, I didn't look up the dates, but I feel like...
But you know, they cast actors except roles that they think are going to shake things up because they don't want to get typecast. So after Pretty Woman, she did Flatliners and was like, we were like, she's like a great actress, you know, she's going to do something serious now. So, but it also, I remember this had the same sort of reaction that the movie Shocker did. Cause you know, as a huge Freddy fan, when Shocker came out, I'm like, yeah, Shocker. Then we watched Shocker. I'm like, Shocker. But you know, Flatliners was kind of the same thing. To be fair, I love Shocker now, but at the time it was a super letdown. Because of social expectation. And Flatliners, I feel, suffered the same way. But Flatliners, to me, I think fits in the category of Exorcist 3, which is like when Exorcist 3 came out, everyone had middle fingers up. Like, this isn't what is this? But I just feel like, you know, if you're going to do a hard stop on stuff and be like, we're going to take away new wave and start grunge, there's going to be a whole lot of angry people, you know? And that's what was happening, is they decided to do a hard stop. And I think that, you know, a lot of this stuff we don't realize is directly influenced by the stuff that was going on socially, like AIDS, and the political stuff that was going on that was really pretty serious, that has affected us all these decades, has affected what a lot of these companies were willing to invest in for entertainment. They were deciding for us what we wanted to watch, and it wasn't always right, you know? And so while I love that they were taking Flatliners and Silence of the Lambs in a more sophisticated direction, I don't know if we were ready for this jump. Do you know what I mean? Like, I feel like we needed a transition.
I think that this is the transition that, yes, like, this movie is a few different things mashed in together. At its heart, it's a mad scientist film, but what it really is a gothic film. It's much more of a ghost story. It's much more of a haunted, it's a religious film too, by the end of it as well. As you guys mentioned, you know, this is the period where people have just gotten sick of the slashers. They've been sequeled to death. And this is the period where we're about to have Francis Ford Coppola's Dracula, you know, Kenneth Branagh's Frankenstein, this movie, Cape Fear in 91. There's this big move towards a little bit more of this gothic type of structure, or hot house kind of like Southern, or this one capturing Chicago at its like most beautiful in autumn, in the type of gothic architecture around Loyola University, which I went to. And that's why this movie stays a little bit close to my heart too, and captures a lot of that pretty universe, or that pretty campus that's gone now, including the Jezrez lawn that was right on the lake that they often walk through. But I do think that this one falls into that category while still being its own strange beast, the way that you guys have described, kind of not a vague movie, not one that really locks down on any one plot. It's more of trapped in a lot of sensory kind of tank imagery, a lot of sound effects. Things that really kind of struck me when I saw this was a kid, and weirdly became one of my favorites and go-to VHSs. I think it was one of my favorites of my mom's, which is why I watched it for the first place. But one.
So,
that was
which one did your mom love? Kiefer, Oliver Platt, Kevin Bacon, or Bargain Baldwin?
I think it was the Bargain. I hate to admit, I think it's the Bargain Baldwin, and it was Kiefer Sutherland, because she watched all of 24 too. But right. I got to tell you, as a gay little kid watching this, like, Oliver Platt's my favorite. Like, I think that he is really the best part of this movie. Like, he realizes a bit more of the film that he's in. He's just like, give me the one-liners. Like, we need to actually make this funny and entertaining.
I got
to
stop you. That's not a Bargain Baldwin. There's still a Billy that hasn't.
Oh, wait. There's this. Okay. Wait. Which is the Republican one?
Yeah, that's Billy Steven. Is the Republican.
No, Steven is the Republican.
Steven's so which one is this? This is Billy?
This is Billy.
This is Billy.
Sorry. Yeah, this is not the Bargain Baldwin. This is a step before the Bargain Baldwin. So
there's also a sub-Bargain Baldwin, Daniel Baldwin.
Yeah.
Who was in... I know him as the villain from Harley Davidson and the Marlboro Romance.
Well, I know Billy as the guy that would always harass my friend, who was a girl that we would go to the mall, and he'd always be like, hey, you haven't given me your number yet. You know, like, you live in LA, you see the real side of these people, but go on.
Sure.
So your mom's favorite movie is this. You get to reap the benefits of that. My mother loved Kurt Russell, so I had access to all of that, and it worked.
Well, Kurt Russell was a babe.
Right. Which I also, Kurt Russell and, oh my God, what's his name? Dirty Dancing.
Swayze.
Patrick Swayze?
Swayze. I thought that they were the same person.
Yeah, they all seem the same. It's that corny 80s style, but like now, I love them both. Love them both.
I'm trying to define the moment we're in. This is the first movie out of like, Silence of the Lambs, Misery, Ghost, everything else we mentioned, like Jacob's Ladder, I think is the closest connected to this movie.
A lot from Jacob's
I always confuse this with Jacob's Ladder, actually.
And Jacob's Ladder came after this. This movie beat all of them to the punch. And I think it suffers by being a high concept horror in the beginning. It's like, okay, this is so cool. We're going to like experiment with death and we're going to go exploring in it. And it doesn't nail that third act. It's missing whatever that is. But everything else that's here, I actually really love. I think it really is effective and it's moody and it pulls me in and I want to know what the fuck is going on. I just wish that climax had more.
It didn't ever get us there. Like it had, like Max said, it was all the gothic horror. It was cool. Even with the score, the lighting, all of it was awesome. And then it just, that last act was like, wait, what? So you've already figured it out and you're just wrapping it up? I wanted to see like crazy shit happen, you know, like make me barf, you know, but whatever. It was cool.
All they had to do was say they were sorry. It's basically a very Catholic film. It's the most Paul Schrader, like gothic action comedy that he never made.
Right. So like I had forgotten everything that the Bargain Baldwin does in this movie. Like him videotaping all of his sexcapades.
Which he also does in Sliver.
I haven't seen Sliver. Now I have to watch that.
He does it in two different movies. Speaking of movies and soundtracks, I know Sliver more for the UB40 cover of...
Red Wine?
No, I Can't Help Falling in Love with You.
Oh, right.
They did a cover for it, and it was for that. And that's how I remember that movie.
Definitely think that these...
I was shocked to see that storyline in today's world, because this feels like if this shows up in a horror movie now, then the trolls on the internet would be like, "You're too woke. Stop doing this to us." But like, it's here. It's been here.
But they didn't do it. There was no resolution with his storyline.
He totally. He was like, "Oh, I shouldn't have done that." Like he had remorse.
He was haunted, and then they just let it be.
And then his fiance leaves him.
Yeah, Hope Davis in her first film role.
It's not a perfect movie by any means. We understand this, but having made films, having investigated the backstory of films, it's got to be obvious that there's some missing ingredient here. Like this was the 3-hour movie that somebody came in and said, make it 90 minutes. I don't care what you cut out. You know what I mean? And they're like, just do it by tomorrow. And something got cut out. Like there's so many storylines. It got missing from this. And I feel like I'd rather watch a 2.5-hour movie of Flatliners than a 90-minute version.
This feels like it's going to be Netflix's next miniseries or an A24 elevated horror movie in about 4 years.
They already remade it.
I didn't watch it. I didn't either. I don't think I need to.
It wasn't a remake. It was actually a direct sequel. Oh. It didn't make it any better, but it was.
And it certainly didn't come back from the dead.
Hold up. The remake is a direct sequel of Flatliners.
The 2017 movie, yeah.
That's also on Tubi. If you want to watch that tonight.
Oh, I love Tubi.
So a direct sequel meaning like similar characters?
Kurt Russell. Kiefer comes back.
Yeah, they carry over Kiefer.
But is he playing his same character? Because I read that he was just really okay, cool. Interesting.
Spoiler.
But everyone else is new. I'm interested in this.
Right. Elliot Page is in there. I don't know who else is in the cast.
Diego Luna.
Diego Luna's in it.
I had a much higher tolerance for it than I think a lot of people did. It got pretty bad reviews. It is also 2 hours, which actually makes me appreciate the 90 minutes of this one, which this I have to agree with you. Like there
this
are
this is not 90 minutes. This is also 2 hours.
Oh, this one, that's right. It is that it feels that long too.
Yeah, it feels longer.
Shut up.
It is 2 hours.
It's 2 hours.
Yeah,
it didn't stop it from being a hit though. Like this was a pretty big hit.
I was shocked by that. I feel like this would be a gamble that probably didn't pay off. But I think that cast alone.
Yeah, it was 1990. Like you bought your ticket just by having that cast alone.
Yeah,
you
know, it didn't have good reception. It was just people went to see it. I remember this vividly. I remember this time. It was like, we went to see it just like we went to see Dracula. Dracula was like a big deal. I hated Dracula.
It's not a good movie.
It has everything that should make me totally like freak out, but I cannot stand, and I love Bill and Ted, but I cannot stand Keanu Reeves as an actor. And Winona Ryder can just suck it. Like, it was just terrible. But everything else was fantastic in that movie. This was sort of the same, where it's like, you go to the movies because how could this not deliver? And then it doesn't deliver, you know?
Period of the 90s feels similar to now. We're like, we're coming out of all these franchises, sequels to death. There has to be a reset. So we're going to remake the classics, Dracula, yeah. Wolfman, Frankenstein. We're going to like throw them all on a blender and make something new for the kids, which I feel like is what Flatliners becomes, this like new take on the mad scientist. And now it's happening to us again. Like, we're getting all these crazy would-be franchises and then a bunch of sequels.
Honestly, to me, when you look at the success of this movie, you have to look at the fact that... So I did look it up while we've been chatting. Pretty Woman came out in March of 1990, and this came out in October. But during that time, the nation fell in love with Julia Roberts.
Yeah.
And she married her co-star, Kiefer Sutherland. And then promptly from left
this movie?
Him. Yes. And then promptly left, or I think they were engaged and then they broke up and then she married Lyle Lovett.
Some of these arrangements are for tabloids only.
Sure, sure. But what I'm saying is people went to see this movie for that reason, for the same reason they went to see George and Martha, whatever year that was, because it was two of the biggest like tabloid stars of the time are in it, and it's where their romance started. So I do think that a lot of its success has to do with that.
I mean, that is why I think I had to watch Overboard as many times as I did as a kid, because the real life romance was just so good, and we're so happy for them.
Well, remember, we've gone from I'm trying to like backtrack a little bit and save all the slander I've said about this movie, which is we've gone from License to Drive to Flatliners in like 6 months, right? I love License to Drive. I loved it when it came out. And that movie was ripped to shit when it came out. Because and if you watch that movie now, it's fabulous. It's a fabulous teen comedy. It's actually better than most of the John Hughes teen comedies in terms of pacing and timing and just that kind of corny fun, right? It was constant fun. Fight me on that. But
then I love License to Drive. You'll get no slander here.
It took a long time.
Which Corey would go best in this movie and as who?
In Flatliners?
Yes. I feel like Feldman, probably.
Corey Feldman would be the red hoodie boy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Nailed it.
I guess you'd say Feldman because you picture him as a sidekick, like someone that's but I actually think Haim because...
Haim could do like the Kevin Bacon character.
Kind of. He was really good at doing...
He's acting for the back of the house in this movie.
Kevin Bacon is? Oh, absolutely he is.
Yeah.
All the time. All the time!
I definitely would go... Like, so here's the thing with... I think no shade to either of these guys. I know that, like, Corey Feldman has really created a name for himself recently, but... Corey Haim has done like some pretty remarkable roles. Like, I don't know if you guys ever saw Lucas, even Silver Bullet. Like, he really knows how to make you love his little character. You know, as a boy, he was great. Before the drugs really took him over, he was quite a remarkable actor. Before the late 80s made him into this like corny, like teen, he really was a fabulous child star. And it's sad that we lost him because he was great in everything he did. I can't picture him in Flatliners, though. I don't see where he would fit. Maybe if he was older, but I do want to say I'm actually glad that we watched it for this because I like that movie now. I actually enjoyed watching it. I don't know if I love the ending, but the ride was fun and I liked watching it, and it kind of made me soften on my impression from when it initially came out. So thank you for that.
Happy to
but help. Yeah, it definitely made me like, now all I think about is like, who was the asshole that came in and like screwed with production and made them cut shit they didn't? Because it definitely seemed like this was supposed to be longer, right?
Well, the producer Michael Douglas, so I guess him.
Yeah, but producers are managing money. So somebody with money was like unhappy, and Michael Douglas had to like, he was the messenger. That's how I feel.
He's holding his own in his producing credits. He's got nothing but hits on his resume. I don't know if you've seen him. But
and he would later be directed by Schumacher in Falling Down.
Oh, right. I hadn't seen that movie.
I haven't either, I don't think.
Does it? But do you guys agree that it seems like this movie has like a giant jump in story?
I feel like the ending is very abrupt. It makes an effort to close up everybody's story, but in none of those efforts are in any way satisfying. And that leads to the final one being when even the final one, he's like, oh, he has something to say. And he's like, today wasn't a good day to die. Ha ha ha.
Right.
Like, and roll credits. Like, that's like the final, like, fuck off to the audience, I feel like.
Right. It's not earning its philosophicalness ever.
There's no, it undermines any philosophicalness that might have had by not making a declaration on anything. And he's like, I'm sorry, I'm gonna just say the opening line of the movie. Like, it robs it of any of that, I feel like.
I had just finished watching Midnight Mass on Netflix before watching this. And I feel like they're both trying to get to the same thing, and they both take different extremes to it. I liked Midnight Mass, but it's like 6 hours too long, with everyone getting monologues.
Yeah. I'm about halfway through myself.
To Mike Flanagan's credit, he is interested in this other side of horror that is about like self-reflection and talking inwards and getting yourself through your own bullshit, which I think is really awesome that we have that. But it's been, you know, 4 or 5 projects now where I'm like, okay, I get it. Like, let's get to
give him a feature film and stop making 12 episodes of stuff. We don't need all that. You can edit yourself.
There were two questions that I wanted to ask the three of you in regards to Flatliners. We've been talking about like the queer themes and stuff that he brought to the Lost Boys. I guess the question I wanted to pose is, what's queer about Flatliners? That was one of the questions. And then the more sort of, it's really just a yes or no, is if you had the opportunity to die for a minute to see the other side and come back, would you take it? Those are your questions.
Absolutely. I would die to tell the story of my experience. I feel like that's my philosophy with everything in life. I'll try it just so I can have a story to tell. But the gayest things in this movie for me is the first shot of nudity we have in the beginning of the movie is a dead dick, corpse, gray penis in the beginning of the movie, which I didn't catch when I was a kid. So watching it now, I was like, oh my God. And then the homoeroticness of the bullying between Kiefer and the red hoodie boy. He like bends over him and spits in his mouth. And like, he's got such a negative reaction to that, that I don't know. It feels very like kink spit play. We're exploring that in this movie as well, which I'm like,
you need Jesus, Tyler.
That's some queer ass shit right there.
Max, I want to hear what you have to say first.
Oh, I think to say something gay about it, Brian, on Flatliners is mostly in the style of this one. Again, it's taking very sumptuous, it's very gay feeling. But I will identify what Tyler said. It's basically, you know, Joel Schumacher sexualizes his men just as much as his women. You know, again, it's just, he's a very sensual director. And this is, again, a very attractive cast, just like Lost Boys. And he's going to take that full advantage of that on the screen.
Would you do it?
Would I do it? Of course I would. Again, for the experience and be able to talk about myself.
I am just fascinated with that refrigerator blanket. I kind of want that like as curtains or something. Like, it just seems really fabulous.
I definitely agree. It's the style. It's his style, you know, like, gays have been in Hollywood forever, and we weren't telling blatantly gay stories. We were telling it through our craft of whatever it was, whether it was the makeup or the lighting or the outfits, whatever it was, that's what we were doing. And I don't believe he was outwardly gay. I think he was just being who he was, which was like, he was a guy who had a flair for the eccentric. If he was a fashion designer, if he was doing fashion photography, he was lighting things in a way that was over the top. That's who he is. And that beckoned to us. But I think that's where it ends for me in the movie in terms of that. I don't think that there was any homoeroticism between any of the characters. The spitting in the mouth was a power play. I don't know if it's sexual. If you see it that way, cool. Would I die to tell people about it? I feel like I've done that a million times. I don't, but honestly, if I, in that situation, I don't think I would, because I don't trust that my body could really come back like that. That just seems like, you know, have someone that's had to deal with a lot of some health stuff. I don't know if like, it's really that simple. So do I care so much to be able to come back and tell people what happened? No, you can find out soon enough, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, they're all,
how about you?
At this point, they're all like in their early 20s. They're like 22, 23 years old. So like, of course they feel like invincible.
Right.
Would I do it? I honestly, I'm a little more on Roman's side, where I'm like, I don't trust my body. I'm like, something would go wrong. I don't trust it. And
see, when you posed the question, I took that to believe that like, oh, you're going to come back.
Well, sure. I guess the question was, if it was posed to you in this situation, would you do it? I guess.
I think Brian's too afraid that he'd have too many ghosts follow him out.
Right.
Every single ring he's covering.
What are you bringing back with you? What did you bring back with you?
Army of Darkness 3 would be my sequel. Like, it would not be cute. So no, for sure. If that's the case, no. It would be bad. But
it's a lot of skeletons.
Also, there's so much to say beyond, like, you know, if you really want to have that kind of talk, I'd say, like, you know, that doesn't prove anything. Like, when your brain goes into shutdown, I know they were saying, the cool thing about this movie is they were saying, like, while you are technically brain dead. So you're not actually going to have brain activity that could possibly be sparking any delusions or dreams, which is cool. But then what the hell? Like, so that's where it kind of bothered me, because I was like, so then what's happening? Like, so where are they? Is this another world where stuff's repeating? If that's the case, wouldn't it just be like void of any earthly activity? I feel like Exorcist 3 was a better example of taking it to this sort of thought process. And they made it a longer movie, but they were like, let's just take this sort of like existential dread and make it into like a more of and put it in a horror movie. And I feel like they succeeded more there without having to spell out like what happens. Just makes you feel scared of that. Have you guys seen Exorcist 3 lately?
No, I've never seen it.
So it came out around the same time, and it had the same sort of reception where everyone was like, Exorcist is a name that means scary. And then when people went to see it, they're like, this is long. There's a lot going on here that we don't care about. But now everyone's loving that movie because they realize, like, oh, we now have the mental capacity for this slow burn movie that's actually genius. It just wasn't what you told us it was going to be when we went to the theater, which is what Flatliners was. They made Flatliners seem like it was going to be sensory overload. And then you get in the movie theater seats and you're like, where is this overload? You just drop the ball, you know? And that's, I think, what was happening here. It was a cross between marketing and the actual product.
It's just like a high concept that they were like, wouldn't that be cool if you could die and then come back? And then they like, what would happen? Oh, maybe you bring something back. How would you get rid of it? I don't know. Maybe you just have to apologize to everybody.
Right.
Like, that's the entirety of the brainstorm. And that became the movie. And that's why it's such a letdown.
There was that movie called Bad Dreams that came out right the same year as Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Dream Warriors. There was Bad Dreams, which also starred Jennifer Rubin from Dream Warriors. And Bad Dreams is in many ways a superior movie in the way that it was written, the script, the acting. Like, there's so much was better about that. That would have made a better Flatliners movie. You know, where you actually deliver the surreal, because that's what you're marketing to people. So I think a lot of this has to do with the way it's presented. You know, if someone said to you, like, you know, if the poster had like some, like, you know, blood dripping off a cross and some sad tear off of a Julia Roberts face, you might be like, okay, I get what I'm going to go see. But when they tell you it's going to be some crazy sci-fi adventure and then this is all you get, people have middle fingers up, you know?
Say what you will. I do love all the dream sequences in this movie. It's very effective, especially Bargain Baldwin's. You'll never remember his name. But when he's dreaming of all the women and they're overlapping and it's very like kaleidoscopic, weird and scary. And I'm like, I don't know, I'm uncomfortable. I think I love nightmare logic in my horror films. I love going one direction, coming out the other side, not knowing how any of this ended up to an extent. In the moment when these sequences are happening, I'm really into them. And as soon as we get to the end, I'm like, I didn't want to wake up from this dream.
Like a bad date?
Right. There's the moment where Julia Roberts is like confronting her father and like noticing that he's like shooting up heroin or something. And the camera is like one shot of her going up the stairs. She gets into the bathroom. And if you're just focusing on the two of them, they're in the center of the frame. If you look at the background, the walls are extending and the tile of the bathroom is getting longer and longer and longer to the point where they can start spinning the camera around. And I'm like, is this like a fun house? Like, I don't know if I'm supposed to notice the fact that the set is moving around them to make sure that the camera can get in to do all these moves and these pans. But I like to think that I'm supposed to see that and that this dream is expanding in real time and she's accepting her dead father. I don't know. I loved it.
There's a lot of stuff like that that really works, I found. And then, like we've discussed, I feel like the movie kind of just doesn't deliver on any of its big ideas, and it kind of just ends unceremoniously.
We didn't even talk about the limping dog in the beginning of the film.
The dog, the whip, yeah, it's terrible. Yeah.
That's why we didn't talk about it, Tyler.
Right, but you're talking about like what works in this movie is like a limping dog makes me feel really bad. Yeah. And I'm supposed to feel bad in this movie, so it's
well, perfect. Also, that girl was tormented all her life and then he goes and apologizes to her. And I actually thought that apology interaction was nice and it seemed sincere. It wasn't short. They really made sure to like, it was good. But at the same time, it's like, wait, is that what this movie is about?
Saying you're sorry?
Saying sorry? Because Julia Roberts didn't have to say sorry. She just walked in on her dad shooting heroin in the bathroom. And now she, why is she being haunted? What'd she do? She walked in. He should be sorry. And I guess he was, but it was still just like, it just felt like kind of sloppy, you know?
Yeah, there's no there's no consistency to like the experiences that they're all having. One guy accidentally murdered somebody, or is, or at least feels responsible for killing somebody. And then another guy was a bully. And then the girl, saw her dad shooting up heroin. Like, at least if it's like a Nightmare on Elm Street, like Freddy is the constant. And it's like that, it's, that's what you're bringing back.
Right.
But it's with this, it's like, is it guilt or is it, you know, just a general, I don't know. It's too vague, which is what's frustrating about it.
Yeah. One change to make this movie better. Oliver Platt should have killed them all.
Yes.
And he should have taken the findings and become a best-selling whatever happens when you're a scientist.
He should have teamed up with Clive Barker for the last act to figure out some sort of resolution that doesn't make you feel good when you leave. You should feel sick. You know what I mean? Like, it should be something that makes you feel like, oh, like if your point is like guilt, then it should make you feel really guilty when you leave. But this makes you feel good about it. Like, oh, that's easy to do. Should not be easy to do. Otherwise, you wouldn't be there.
Thank you so much to both of you for coming on. This was so much fun. I could probably...
Thank you for having us.
Absolutely. Yes. I could chat another 2 hours about the wonder and the queerness of Joel Schumacher.
And we didn't even talk about The Incredible Shrinking Woman, which is my favorite.
That is my favorite too.
Well, I did want to say one last thing. Like, the whole embodiment of the Lost Boys goes hand in hand with like, Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead and Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. And I feel like regardless of how you feel about those movies, there's like this holy trinity of late 80s style that is Joel Schumacher, like really nailed the horror version. There's Bill and Ted that's like the comedy sci-fi, and then there's like, you know, the teen drama with Christina Applegate. And I feel like those things were so impactful to us as early preteens, and that whatever he did, he got it right. And I, you know, whatever his intentions were, like, he really nailed it, and I appreciate it, because a lot of movies at that time just didn't get it, you know, at all. They didn't get style. They didn't get teenagers. They didn't get music. And thank you, Joel. That's all I have to
Rest
say.
Rest in peace.
Yeah.
Rest in peace.
Yes.
Well, like I said, thank you so much for coming on. Do you want to share with us your social media so our listeners can find you?
Yes. I am Tyler Ray Jensen on Instagram. I am Tyler Kinesis on TikTok. Though I keep getting banned for being too sexy for teens.
Sure.
I wish that was just a joke. But no, TikTok can't handle homosexuality, and I got receipts.
Oh, Tyler and I are Scream Queen Doc on everything. So if you want to find us on there, if you want to follow the Scream Queen movie and Mark Patton, Scream Queen Doc is there. I'm Dracula Spectacular on Instagram currently. You find it. You can see cool posts of my goth makeup and otherwise my dog. And, you know, that's where we're at.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And everyone listening, if you haven't, please go and check out Scream Queen, My Nightmare on Elm Street. It's the definitive documentary on the definitive queer horror film of my lifetime. Honestly, I love that movie. You can find the podcast on Piece of Pie Pod. That's on Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. I am so Brian Rowe. That's Brian with an IROWE. And Max, what about you?
And I'm at Max Bever on Instagram.
Excellent. Thank you so much. This was a lot of fun. These movies are queer and fabulous, and I'm so happy you boys came on and discussed them with us. So thanks so much. Happy Halloween, everybody. We'll be back at you next time with, finally, we're covering the Scream film. So stay tuned and like and subscribe so you don't miss out.